The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Today on the Town Hall Review, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy, a look back at the life and presidency of George H.W. Bush.
The best father a son or daughter could have. And in our grief, let us smile knowing that Dad is hugging Robin and holding Mom's hand again.
George W. Bush honors his father.
Last Friday, when I was told he had minutes to live, I called him. I said, Dad, I love you, and you've been a wonderful father. And the last words he would ever say on earth were, I love you too.
And in France, why the riots?
We are overtaxed everywhere, anywhere. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Later, a longtime red section of California turns blue.
Trump just has not played well in California.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday live, 6 a.m. to 9 a.m., and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com. George Herbert Walker Bush died just over a week ago at the age of 94. The 41st president of the United States, Bush was a great man who left the country better by the end of his term. His son, George W. Bush, spoke at the service this week.
Last Friday, when I was told he had minutes to live, I called him. The guy answered the phone, said he, I think he can hear you, but he hadn't said anything for most of the day. I said, Dad, I love you, and you've been a wonderful father. And the last words he would ever say on earth were, I love you too.
He came into a job perhaps as the most prepared president in history, and he was a true war hero. He was one of nine shot down during a bombing raid in World War II. He was the only one in that group to avoid capture. He was a terrific parent. Two of his children became successful governors, one a two-term president of the United States. He touched people in ways that surprised many. Here again is son George W. at the memorial.
He had an enormous capacity to give of himself. Many a person would tell you that Dad became a mentor and a father figure in their life. He listened and he consoled. He was their friend. I think of Don Rhodes, Taylor Blanton, Jim Nance, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and perhaps the unlikeliest of all, the man who defeated him, Bill Clinton. My siblings and I refer to the guys in this group as brothers from other mothers.
And one of his greatest accomplishments, he was married 73 years to Barbara Bush, the longest lasting marriage of any U.S. president. Barbara Bush died in April of this year.
Finally, every day of his 73 years of marriage, Dad taught us all what it means to be a great husband. He married his sweetheart. He adored her. He laughed and cried with her. He was dedicated to her totally.
They are together again. At the beginning of the week, I looked at the life of George H.W. Bush on the Hugh Hewitt Show. I'm joined by Michael Shear of the New York Times, who's, of course, been covering politics from the White House for many a year. And it is one of those rare times when people put down the cudgels, Michael Shear, at least for 3 days, don't you think?
Yeah, I do. I think it reminds us of as the former president would have said, a kinder, gentler time. My very, very first story ever covered in Washington was as an intern for the Los Angeles Times was George H.W. Bush's inauguration. I was standing along the cold Pennsylvania Avenue in the cold, and it does feel like a million years ago because it does feel like a different kind of politics, different kind of generation. And my suspicion is that the animosity that we would have felt in this city during this week, budget fights and the like, will probably be somewhat muted because of that.
You know, Michael, if you go around, you'll find lots of Bushies. I'm a Bushie. The fetching Mr. Hewitt is a Bushie. These are people who in the interim between President Ford and President Reagan's nomination worked for George H.W. Bush's volunteers or cheered him on because he represented a different kind of politics in 1978-79. Right. They're still all over the place, whether it's Andy Card. I mean, they're just everywhere. So it's kind of deep in the city, but it's been obscured by his son's presidency and by President Trump's presidency. But there are a lot of Bushies around.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think what is remarkable about that, too, and the fact that it's so enduring, is that in many ways, you know, George H.W. Bush seemed like he would be overshadowed by his predecessor as well, Ronald Reagan, right? That he Reagan, of course, had two terms. Bush only had one. And so I think in the immediate aftermath of Bush's presidency, there were folks talking about how he would be more of an asterisk, that he would, you know, sort of just connected between the two, you know, between Reagan and Clinton. But, you know, it really has become an enduring part of the American presidential landscape, in part because of who he was and kind of his genteelness, but also in part because of what he was there to witness and to help guide the country through the end of the Cold War and the first Gulf War and the like. Those are enduring moments in American history, and I think that's partly why his legacy is what it is today.
Go to townhallreview.com for the rest of that discussion and sign up for a podcast. You'll get the best of talk radio every day. In 1980, George Bush ran for president. He finished second in a crowded field to Ronald Reagan. Here's my friend and colleague Michael Medved.
Reagan and Bush had run against each other in 1980. They had a very spirited campaign. People may know or may remember that George Herbert Walker Bush won the Iowa caucuses. And he won fairly comfortably, and he wasn't supposed to because most people hadn't heard of him. Everybody knew who Reagan was. He had almost been nominated for president 4 years before. But in 1980, George Herbert Walker Bush won the Iowa caucus, and President Reagan then had to reshape his entire campaign. He was then Governor Reagan. He knew that if he lost in New Hampshire, it was over for him because a front runner would be shown to be vulnerable. He beat President Bush, then Ambassador Bush. He beat him in New Hampshire, but then they had this long, bitter campaign. Bush won in states like Michigan and Pennsylvania, but Reagan won the rest, and he won the nomination. Afterward, he not only chose the man he had defeated, but this shows you some of the brilliance of Reagan. He chose Bush's closest friend and ally and campaign manager, James Baker, to be his, Reagan's, chief of staff. And Baker did an outstanding job. And the result of having the vice president being your former rival, who was an outstanding vice president, incredibly loyal to President Reagan, and then having the aide, the most classic of all the Bushies, the someone who was deeply connected to the whole Bush family, James Baker, as Reagan's chief of staff, nothing needed to be more to be done to bring the Republican Party together entirely and to help bring the country together, which Reagan did. This is James Baker speaking to Jake Tapper on CNN about the last moments of President Bush. He was with him right up till the end. Listen.
You were there for his last words, which were to his oldest son, President George W. Bush. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, then later on, as it became obvious that he was probably going to pass that evening, they got all the kids on the phone. You know, when somebody's passing away, the last sense that goes is the hearing, and they can hear things. So they got the kids on the phone, and each one of them spoke to him, and he spoke back or mumbled back anyway. And then they got 43 on the phone, and 43 said, "I love you, Dad, and I just want to, and I'll see you in heaven." And 41 said, "I love you too." And those were the last words that he ever spoke.
We should all have such last words.
James Baker also said to the press that earlier, when he came in and Bush recognized him, the president recognized him, he called him Bake. He said, "Where are we going today, Bake?" And Baker answered back, "I think we're going to heaven." And then, of course, President Bush reportedly said, I'd like that. And this goes along with that incredibly moving cartoon that went super viral around the world. And it was done by a cartoonist named Ramsey in Mississippi. And he wrote about it. And for people who haven't seen it, and I think everybody in the whole world has seen it, it shows one of those Grumman Avengers, the plane that Bush flew 58 combat missions on, and it's resting up in the clouds. And it shows him getting out, and he's joining hands with Barbara Bush, white hair, and then with a little blonde girl. And that would be his daughter, Robin, who he lost when she was 3 years old. And the caption for the cartoon by Ramsey from the Mississippi Clarion Ledger was, "We've been waiting for you." And that was obviously spoken by Barbara and Robin. But there's a photograph of the funeral home in Houston, and it shows the president's casket. It's draped in a flag, and in front of it is Sully, who was the late president's service dog, who lies down right in front of the casket, very close to it. Who knows what dogs can understand? But people can understand, and certainly people not only who are close to President Bush, but people who were inspired by his example. And I think particularly the amazing thing about his example, at a time when very few people would describe our politics at the moment as nice, he ran a tough and aggressive campaign to beat Michael Dukakis. And a lot of people think he lost the election in 1992 to Bill Clinton because he didn't play tough enough. He was president of the United States. And he was consumed by his day job, and the campaigning was something of an afterthought. In any event, in 1979, he was on Face the Nation. And they immediately asked him if he was too nice to be president. And he spoke about character and what real toughness was. Here's what that sounded like.
Among even your friends of the minority who know who you are and who admire you in the party, one of the things that always comes up is that maybe George Bush is too nice a guy to be president. Maybe he's not tough enough.
Yeah, I've heard
that. You can't take out after, what about the tough enough question? And
well,
start
tough
out,
enough
but
is
don't
I don't,
to take
equate,
out after
I don't
these
equate
other guys.
Toughness with just attacking some individual. I don't attack. I equate toughness with moral fiber, with character, with principle, with demonstrated leadership in tough jobs where you emerge, not bullying somebody, but with the respect of the people you led. That's toughness. That's fiber. That's character. I've got it. And if I happen to be decent in the process, that should not be a liability.
Our program is coming in today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They are preparing grounded leaders who are impacting public policy and serving in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up.
We are overtaxed everywhere, anywhere. I mean, it's unbelievable.
The socialist disaster in France when the Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review, brought to you in partnership with ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Hugh Hewitt. What began as demonstrations in France 3 weeks ago quickly evolved into riots. The culprit? High taxes, particularly fuel taxes, intended to help the environment. France also has high unemployment, especially among its youth. That combination is lethal. This week, the once popular president of France, Emmanuel Macron, canceled the gas tax. Salem host Dennis Prager spoke with Philippe Carsonti, French media analyst, stationed at the moment at the heart of those protests, Paris.
This was a lot of rural Frenchmen who are protesting the increase in petrol prices and gasoline prices because of the French government's deep concern about carbon emissions. And it is affecting poorer Frenchmen and rural Frenchmen much more than the more wealthy. Is that an accurate description of the origins?
Yes, this is exactly what happened. But I tell you something, you know, because of the so-called environment war, you know, that they're telling us that we should use our cars much less, you know, they want to make people pay much more for their gas, you know, pay more taxes and that, and to prevent people from using their cars. But the main problem is that the people who have to use their car are the poor ones, you know, who the ones who don't live in big cities, who don't have public transportation, you see. So that's dramatic for them. That's terrible.
Just approximately, what does a Frenchman pay for gasoline?
Around $6.
Right. So and now he has raised it above $6?
Yeah, like something very small, like maybe 2%. But, you know, it's just the idea, it's just the concept, you know, just more and more taxes.
Right.
You know? And, you know, we are overtaxed everywhere, anywhere. I mean, it's unbelievable.
What is the justification for such high taxes? Is it always been to get people to go into public transport?
No. First, it was just a way to raise taxes, you know, to put more money in the for the government, and it was not fully, you know, it was not painful, but then it became more and more, and you know, it's 1 cent and then one more cent, and when now, you know, the next rise of price will be 3 cents per liter, you know, it's ridiculous, you know, it would be like 10 cents per gallon, it's ridiculous, but it's really something, you know, psychologically people just can't stand it anymore. Not only because of what they're paying for when they're putting gasoline in the car, but because everything became so expensive with the euro, and the people don't get more money. You know, they pay much more for everything. They have less service from the government and more taxes. So that's unbearable.
I'm sure you have sympathy for the anti-higher and higher taxes on gasoline. But I assume you don't have sympathy for burning cars.
Yeah, exactly. The problem is that I have no sympathy for people burning cars and rioting and looting and everything. But the main problem is that we're dealing with a government which is completely silent. They're not answering the question. They're not reacting, you know. You have to understand, we have a brainwashing in France about environment, which is amazing. You know, Macron was in Argentina for the G20, and Paris was burning, you know, literally burning. And he gave a press conference at 8 p.m. when the city, and I was, it's my city, I was there, I could see it burning. And you could hear Macron on TV talking about environment. Not a single word about what was happening in Paris.
One state here in the U.S. that appears to be copying the leadership of France, California. High taxes, liberal policies. Thankfully, it's still a step or two behind France, though. So no riots as of yet. And in the recent election, even the formerly Republican enclave of Orange County, California, turned blue. I discussed the development with Pete Peterson, dean of the School of Public Policy at Pepperdine University.
I look up and I see my beloved Orange County went red for my entire 28 years there, and I leave 2 years ago. Now it's all blue. So I'm really wondering what the hell happened.
Well, Hugh, it's a number of factors. If you look at really party registration going back to 2012, you can see the red and blue lines begin to narrow. I mean, you go back to 2012, Republicans in each of the major congressional districts in Orange County held about a 25% to 30% voter registration and turnout advantage. And over the last 6 years, it's narrowed to the point where all of those four major districts in Orange County have been flipped.
Now, when flipped, that tells me that it was a blue tide in California that was on both coasts. But it also tells me it's an opportunity for the Republican Party to go out and recruit some young, preferably 9/11 veterans, preferably minorities, preferably women, and run. Mimi Walters lost, but that district, that's my old district, that's a Republican district. That really is not a tenable situation for Democrats to hang on to. Am I being too optimistic?
I don't think so, Hugh. I agree with your read on this. Obviously, Republicans were hurt not only in Orange County, but you look even in some of the districts in the Central Valley. You look at that Jeff Denham race up north. You look at the David Valadao race, really in the Fresno Bakersfield area. These are longstanding Republican districts, and I think that it does have to call to attention to Republicans in California that they need to be finding the candidates that fit the district. But I do think that Trump just has not played well in California. I don't think he was particularly helpful. And I think in that, Republicans have to find a strategy in California that cuts a different course, that California Republicans are a different breed or a breed apart. And I think in that, you're right. I don't think that this blue wave is sustainable in Orange County and many of these other longstanding Republican districts, but there does need to be an overhaul of the party's identity in California.
I think that may come with an assist from the new governor, Gavin Newsom. And here I look across the Atlantic to France, and I see the yellow vest protests. Yep. 3 weeks of violence, the president of France capitulating this morning, suspending the fuel tax. They went too far, at least too fast, for the people of France in proposing a 5% fuel tax. They ain't seen nothing yet when Gavin Newsom and supermajorities of Democrats run the blue state that is California. They're going to run people right out of there. Maybe they'll come to be a student at the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and enjoy Malibu for a couple of years. But they're not going to stick around if Gavin Newsom puts into place, a 17% income tax? Is that on the books?
Well, I have to say, Hugh, I completely agree with that evaluation. Whenever I speak about the Republican fortunes in California, I always say I'm short-term pessimistic, medium-term optimistic. And the reason that I am optimistic is in politics, you have to compete against something. And I think what's happened to the Democratic Party in California is in some ways a mirror of what you're seeing nationally, which is what I call the Bernie-fication of the Democratic Party. And that power and the discussion around a single-payer plan for the state and various environmental regulations to fight against lower and middle class jobs. I think all these things are on the table, and Republicans need to be ready to respond. But I definitely see the Democrats in their new position of supermajority power in California going overboard.
I want to talk to you for a moment about a group I've done work with for years, ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. You've seen how your freedom is under attack, but if you act now, you can protect your family today and generations to come. Go to townhallreview.com to find out how you can join Alliance Defending Freedom to help ensure the opponents of freedom don't dictate your future. That's townhallreview.com. Coming up.
The last thing he said to me about it is he said, don't publish it if it's not worthy.
Daniel Krauthammer on his father's latest book when the Town Hall Review continues in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Earlier this year, we lost Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist Charles Krauthammer. He was a frequent guest on my program, one of the sharpest minds in America. It was a great loss for us all. But at the time of his death, Charles Krauthammer was working on another book based upon essays and speeches he'd written and given. With the help of his son, Daniel Krauthammer, that book is now out. The title, The Point of It All, A Lifetime of Great Loves and Endeavors. I've read it, and it is magnificent. Daniel Krauthammer joined me on the Hugh Hewitt Show. And I'm going to start with the happier things and then go to the enduring political theory of Charles Krauthammer, which comes in two essays, one on constitutionalism and one on the authoritarian temptation, which I think are worth the price of the book alone, The Point of It All. But I wanted to start with a little bit of happier stuff. But first, Daniel, that you were editing it is not happy because your father died rather unexpectedly, shocking us all. I was talking with friends at the Aspen Security Forum. It's just not the same. How did this book come to be written, and how did you and he talk about it when he got his last diagnosis that he was not long for this world?
Yeah, it was, it was a hard thing doing this. I'm very glad I was able to, but obviously he was very difficult, and I would have given anything for him to have been able to complete this rather than it be me. He had been working on this for quite some time before he got sick and was hospitalized. And had actually had plans for a couple books going forward. And when he was in the hospital for 10 months, I was with him constantly that whole time. And there were, for much of that, things were on the mend, and we expected to get better. There was a light at the end of the tunnel. And I had jerry-rigged all kinds of stuff in his hospital room for him to be able to work and use the computer and talk to his office. So he was working on it in little bits here and there and putting kind of starting to refine the structure and also thinking about combining some of the ideas that were originally going to be different books, but into one. And then, as you said, the final prognosis was not one that we expected. It was only a few weeks between that and the end. At that time, he entrusted it to me to finish for him. And I had been helping him and talking with him about it kind of all throughout the month. So I had a sense where he wanted to go. I knew what he was focusing on. But the thing that that was most important and that I remember imprinted on my soul is the last thing he said to me about it is he said, don't publish it if it's not worthy. And I promised him that I would follow those directions. So I did everything I possibly could. I poured myself into making the rest of the completion of the book as good as I could possibly make it, so that I could live up to what the book deserved and what he deserved.
That you succeeded so spectacularly. I think that the point of it all will be the companion book to When Thing to Things That Matter on every bookshelf where Things That Matter is. They will also have the point of it all because it's the same voice. And you've done a beautiful job of editing, by the way. I don't know if you ever heard him when he was talking with me about you. He was incredibly proud of you on the air and of his father and mother and of his departed brother. We talked at length about his family, but he was incredibly proud of you. I don't know if you ever heard that.
I don't think I heard his conversations with you, and I do hear that a lot from his friends and colleagues. I think I always got a little too embarrassed when he talked about that kind of stuff, so I think he didn't press it on me too hard.
Well, he was effusive, and it's now deserved because of this. Let's talk briefly. You and I talk very briefly. I don't like to leave questions on the cutting room floor by talking to authors before they come on. But when we did talk, I told you that the essay on constitutionalism had just hit me like a rock. It's everything I believe. It's the essence. It's the distillation of the new conservatism. But have other people said to you, thank God you rescued that? And that's a speech at Hillsdale, so it's probably him in primus. But
yeah,
it needed to be in this book.
Absolutely. And that's actually, that was my exact reaction when I found the speech, because that was not something that my father had originally chosen. He hadn't had speeches in his original compilation, but I was searching through everything he ever wrote and said afterwards to make sure that his voice was properly captured, and knowing this would be the last chance, so to speak, to really imprint some of his most important ideas. And when I came across that speech, I was looking through YouTube and going through old speech transcripts, and I just started clapping almost. It was just, as you say, almost perfect. It just encapsulates his political philosophy, his view on America, his view on conservatism, and his brand of conservatism, so to speak, that I knew from that moment that this was going to be the anchor piece for that section of the book.
Our program is coming today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up, women are waiting much longer before having children, if at all.
Some of them literally look at me and say, why didn't anybody tell me? Why was I mistaken about children and the blessing and how much they change your life in a good way?
A longtime pediatrician discusses the plummeting birth rate when the Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review, brought to you in partnership with ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Dr. Robert Hamilton has been a pediatrician in the Southern California area for decades. In that time, he has personally witnessed what statistics bear out, the stunning decline in children. People are marrying later, if at all, and they're having children much later, if at all. He spoke with host Dennis Prager.
When I speak to young people, it is apparent that an inversion of all of history has taken place. Children are now regarded by vast numbers of Americans as impediments to happiness.
That is very true. And it's true because they don't know. They've been told that children bring a lot of work. If you talk to any of my young parents, they'll tell you, yes, we're up all night. We do a lot. We have diapers. We have food. We have to change them. This and do that. We take them here and they get sick. There are a lot of things. But, interestingly enough, Dennis, in preparation for this interview, yesterday I was having I was interviewing my patients. And I held up their child and said, what has this child brought to your life? And some of them with tears in their eyes said, number one was joy. Number two, just laughter and happiness. Another guy said purpose. Another woman said everything. I'm not sure what she meant by everything, but everything. And so when you actually begin to have children, when they actually come into your life and you realize that, of course, they're work. Of course, we all know that. But when you begin to realize the blessing and the joy and the delight and how children light up virtually every room that they walk into, they begin to kind of go, wow, we didn't know this. I've had women really, truly in their mid-30s have their first child, which is becoming more and more common. And they come into my office, and look, I talk to my patients. They know who I am and what I'm up to, and I get to know them. And I say, tell me about this. You're 35, and some of them literally look at me and say, why didn't anybody tell me? Why was I mistaken about children and the blessing and how much they change your life in a good way, in a good way? And children really do, they mature us. They take us out of ourselves, and if anything, and this is a good thing too, they bring us into the next generation. They thrust us by definition. We are, as a father, I'm concerned about, 20 years from now, what will be happening.
Yep, that's a very good point. You think in that way. Do you know young women who are opting not to have children or that obviously they're not going to come to your practice, but do you know them at all in life?
I do. There are a couple of them. Some of them sadly have, the way life has gone, they've been married, divorced or whatever, and they've kind of gone beyond their years where they can have children. And they've come to that point where they said, I don't want children. Okay. Well, there aren't too many that I'm aware of that actively, in their early 20s, mid-20s, unless some kind of terrible dysfunction has happened in the family, say, I never want to have children. I know they're out there because I read like you read, but I don't run into them.
Dr. Bob, I met a woman just recently at a certain get-together. So I frequently ask young women, in fact, I'll ask them, how old are you? So she turns out she was 34, and I asked her, are you married? No. And do you want to get married? And then she gave the answer that most troubles me, and that is, if somebody comes around, that'll be fine. But I'm preoccupied with my career, her career being acting, which is particularly dangerous because very few people ever make it in acting, just the nature of the beast, as it were. But the reason I'm telling you this is what really fascinated me is the woman goes to church every Sunday. And I asked on the air, maybe you're a churchgoer, so tell me, are Christian churches not advocating marriage? Is it an unspoken issue?
It was certainly in our church, we talk about marriage all the time. We have a lot of young people. We have a lot of children in our congregation. So in our congregation, we do talk about marriage. For whatever reason, though, there are plenty of congregations, and they can be conservative and more to, more liberal in their theology, who are not really getting up there and saying we need to have children.
We even need to get married. Let's start with that.
Let's start with that. Yeah, exactly. It isn't happening. And I'll tell you what it is. It represents really we're acclimatizing ourselves to the culture. And that is happening in churches throughout the country. We kind of look at the culture as kind of leading the church rather than the church leading the culture.
Today, if you meet a woman who's 25, married and has a child, she is the outlier.
She would be the outlier.
Yes. This is brand new in American history.
It really is, and definitely in urban America. In rural America, it's still happening. It happens all the time. When I have those kind of people, by the way, I have a handful in my practice who are relatively young mothers. I look at them and I ask them, I say, where did you get your common sense? Because I want to know what is the motive, you know, what is it about them?
That is a great question. Where did you get your common sense? Give me a happy surprise. Tell me one. I've had 1 year olds. What's a happy surprise?
Well, one great happy surprise I found as I researched the book was at the point of conception, there's a flash of light. And so when the ovum and the sperm actually unite, and it usually happens in the fallopian tube, there's actually an influx of calcium ions, okay, into that that zygote, and there is an exit of zinc ions, and that zinc exit causes there to be literally a spark. There's a little flash of light that happens.
That's not a surprise. Everybody listening knew that. Give me a break.
So, you know, when you think about this, this has been going on, Dennis, for the millennium. And, you know, I think about this. I think this is like a little thing that God has looked at and said, you know, let there be light, let there be life. And it kind of goes, it kind of like one of those things that you kind of go, wow, this has been going on forever. That flash of light, that kind of annunciation, if you will, of new life.
I want to talk to you for a moment about a group I've done work with for years, ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. You've seen how your freedom is under attack, but if you act now, you can protect your family today and generations to come. Go to townhallreview.com to find out how you can join Alliance Defending Freedom to help ensure the opponents of freedom don't dictate your future. That's townhallreview.com. Coming up.
With black audiences, the words were simpler. They tended to be monosyllabic. They were much less demanding. They were easy, they were direct, they were, as the professors put it, dumbing it down for black audiences.
Michael Medved with the final segment of the Town Hall Review in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. A recent Prager University video showed black Americans responding to the left's idea that they aren't capable of voting with ID. It was telling and entertaining. All were shocked that anyone would believe they can't do something so simple. But that isn't where the condescension of the left ends. Here's Michael Medved.
There's a study, and I've read part of it. It's by Susan Fiske, who's a professor of psychology and public affairs at Princeton, and Sidney Dupree, who's an assistant professor of organizational behavior at Yale. So there are two very well-credentialed social psychologists. And they were trying to measure racist language as they defined it through a series of tests and evaluations. And part of it involved looking at the political speeches that had been delivered to black audiences versus white audiences over a long period of time. And one of the things they found is that among liberals, Democrats and Democratic-aligned and liberal candidates, there was a very, very notable difference between the way they addressed black audiences and the way they addressed white audiences. With black audiences, the words were simpler. They tended to be monosyllabic. They were much less demanding. They were easy. They were direct. They were, as the professors put it, dumbing it down for black audiences. For conservatives, by the way, no difference. No, it's remarkable. Now, they have a little footnote here. They say, well, of course, it was hard to find that many speeches by conservative politicians aimed directly at black audiences. But at least those they did find, or those that they did indicate, people did not change their style of speaking. You know what I'm thinking of? Do you remember that incredibly embarrassing Hillary Clinton moment? I think she was in Selma, Alabama, and she was doing a black dialect. It was because she was reciting the words of a spiritual. Can you imagine the bonfire that would be made if a conservative had done that? And by the way, what they find here, one of the other interesting little experiments they used is a test for some of the people who volunteered for this subject, and they divided them to liberals and conservatives. And they found that the same rule applied. I'll tell you how they did the test. They said, okay, imagine you're holding a book club meeting, and you wanted to personalize your descriptions of the book based upon who you're sending the letter to. And they gave them a choice. You're sending a letter either to Lakeisha, or they had what they claim is the most stereotypical white name, Emily. With Lakeisha, they used simple words like sad, happy. With Emily, they used words like euphoric or melancholy. Oh, please.
Thanks for joining us for this edition of Town Hall Review. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin and producers Charlie Richards, David Posian, Michael Cook, Adam Ramsey, and the meteorologist himself, Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsors, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. Thank you for joining us.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.